Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm William Miller. My guest is Caroline Bock, author of the novel The Other Beautiful People, about the life and loves of a character named Amy Green. What happens to Amy, of course, is what we're here to talk with Caroline about. So welcome, Caroline. Glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start this by talking about the title itself, The Other Beautiful People. What does that refer to?
Well, there's an old sort of theater term, all the beautiful people. And I was actually at a theater rehearsal, Good Man Charlie Brown, at Wooten High School. My daughter was the musical conductor, but I was there as a parent helping. And the theater director, teacher, wonderful teacher, Dr. Laz, said to all the kids, "You beautiful people, get ready. Wrap up your snacks." And then he said to another group of kids, "You other beautiful people over there, you also get ready." And I had the light bulb go off in my head. He said, "That's the title, The Other Beautiful People. It's all the other people who are the below the line people, the behind the scenes people who make TV and film happen." And that's who I was for many years.
And Amy works for one of those behind-the-scenes, front-presenting kind of organizations called the Cinema Channel. What does it do? I mean, in your made-up world, what does the Cinema Channel do?
Well, the Cinema Channel is a cable TV network, and it's built on my experience working at American Movie Classics, at Bravo, and at the Independent Film Channel. And I'm using their full names because back when they were launched, that's what we did. And these were cable TV networks that showed movies uncut and commercial free in the way HBO does now, but did it on basic cable. I don't know if that's too in the weeds from my cable TV experience, but they are something different today and they're all good. No comment on that. But Amy was at that moment in time where people thought you could show classic movies, independent movies, international movies, back to back, and people would watch. And they largely did watch. We had very loyal fans.
A somewhat different world than it is now. And in a sense, you sort of illustrate that in the present writing moment where you refer, I think, to Netflix back in the day when they put them in an envelope and mailed them off to you and you watched it and then mailed it back in.
Yeah, so people who remember Netflix, it was this really scrappy startup that would send you a DVD in the mail, and you would actually sign up for the movies online, which was also a very new thing, and go into a queue. And then out of the blue, your little DVD packaged in a red envelope would appear in the mail, and you would have so much time to watch it, and you were supposed to mail it back. And that was a breakthrough. And what did breakthrough? You didn't have to go to your Blockbuster and get a DVD or VHS and have to then return it to Blockbuster. This appeared miraculously in the mail.
And you could rank them and do all kinds, play all kinds of games. That was a whole nother world.
Right. And you would be like, "Oh, I want to get this movie because everybody's watching it, or nobody knows about this and it'll go up in the ranks." I actually met with Netflix very early in their development and did one of the first promotions they ever did, where they put a promotion for the Independent Film Channel and Bravo on those red packets in exchange for us doing some promos or commercial spots on our air. And I always thought, gee, what if, as though my life is all filled with one if, what ifs, what if I had gone to Ted Sarandos and said, "Is there a job at Netflix? I may be out in California." But I didn't do that because I loved the job I had, which at the time was at Bravo and AMC and IFC.
It is interesting you have a character say, Netflix, that's not going to work, right?
Right. We had so many discussions, Bill, that Netflix wouldn't work, that the internet would be just something very specialized. Why would anyone have to own their own computer when they had a desktop at work? You know, laptop, if you caught this, that the character Amy carries, it's like 15 pounds. I mean, nobody carried a laptop around because it was like lugging a piece of luggage.
Your novel, though, is not set in the present day, if people aren't picking up on this. It has a historic but recent history setting.
Yes.
You begin with this youngish woman. Amy is about 40?
She's, I think, 42, 43, in that range.
And she is higher than middle-level management in a kind of creative role. Sort of want to get that established for people. And the opening scene is her on the porch of a house in a Maryland suburb of D.C. And her boss, who's in New York, calls her. And that's where she's been working. And he calls her and he's like, it's like 12:30. And it's a Sunday night. And they have an unwritten rule, or maybe an espoused, you know, almost written rule. We don't call each other that late on Sunday, but she knows it's him. She answers. And he immediately says, we need a new logo. And she's off and running. She responds to that urge, to that creative spark as they play off of each other. Correct? Have I got that right?
Yes, you got it. I mean, not an unusual occurrence in real life and not an unusual occurrence for Amy Green. It's also that she's in, for the first time, not in her entire life, living outside New York. She finds herself in Silver Spring. So she's, you know, like seeing the world in a whole different light and actually jumps on going back into the world she knows, which is work.
Why did she and her husband leave New York?
Well, ostensibly, he got a job down at another cable network called the Ingenuity Channel. All of these are made up, but, you know, inspired by real works. And also, he basically survived 9/11. He was down there just moments before the plane hit, which in my real life, my husband was down at the World Trade Center at about 8:15. Just coincidentally, not traveling on the A train, not his usual commute.
So you start with this kind of conversation between Amy and her boss, and then there's a flashback to 9/11. And I must admit, it makes a pretty powerful opening when you have that flashback. But then your evocation of the chaos of 9/11 is really powerful. Were you there? I mean, you saw it yourself. You spoke of your husband, but you saw it yourself from out of a window or something?
Well, I wasn't in Manhattan. I was on my way into Manhattan. And that morning, we were supposed to have a press conference, a Bravo press conference on a show called The It Factor. And it was going to be downtown. And it was a big deal. And I just happened to have to stop in the office to fix one thing or get one press kit element together. I don't even know. I was the senior vice president, so I was always racing everywhere. And I did literally get a call from my director, and she said, Caroline, turn on the TV. You're not going to believe what's happened. So I was not in Midtown Manhattan on that Tuesday. By that Thursday, I was in Manhattan. We had two offices. I had a Long Island office and a Midtown Manhattan office right across from Penn Station. So I knew from close friends, I knew from my husband, who when he got off the train in Brooklyn, went up to his office, he watched firsthand the second plane hit.
Part of what I think is so powerful about your evocation of it is you move close and far. There's this kind of sliding, if you will, between that and the details, and the proximity that shifts makes us there in a sense, you know? And like Amy is kind of running away, and there's a worker guy who's there, and they sort of have a moment of recognition. And she's sweating from running, and he's sweating from either from running or working, whichever it is. And they briefly hold hands. It was a good moment.
That was totally fiction, though the path that she was on, I lived for many, many years on 84th Street and between two different apartments, but basically between First and York. So I knew that path, and I knew that if I still had lived there at that moment, how I would run home, which would have been by the UN. So I thought, knowing Amy, she would have had a moment with somebody. She has a lot of moments with people in the book, because I think that's very New York too, where you meet strangers. And for that moment, they're the most important person in your life. You don't know their names. It doesn't matter. They're there for you. She does it later in the book with an unhoused person. She does it with the security guard.
Yeah. And she does remark upon it too. On 9/11, she gets home and she's looking for her husband, and she finds him on the roof, and he's wearing flip-flops and shorts, and that's all. He's thrown his interview suit, not just a suit, but his interview suit, and his tie and his shirt and his shoes even, which he didn't get polished, into the trash. And it's because they're covered in ash. And his debate with himself is whether it's DNA or just ash from the building.
In real life, when I finally got home on 9/11 and my husband finally got home, he was on the last train out of Brooklyn. I walk in the door and he was just like that. Now, it wasn't an apartment, but again, I actually situated them in an apartment I had lived in, so I knew they could get to the roof. But in real life, when I got home, my husband said, he's a lawyer, not a PR guy in real life. And he said, I threw my suit away. I threw my shoes away. I threw everything away. I've taken 3 showers. Don't touch me.
And Amy's husband, Jack, you have him say, don't ever ask me about what happened today, ever.
Yes, I built this on my own personal experience with my husband. That's what he said to me. It took us probably 20 years to talk about it. He lost 60 pounds after that day because he said, I'm never going to be the guy who can't run down 10 flights of stairs again. And he never gained it back.
Does he go out and run?
No, he doesn't run. He doesn't run. He's had since then heart condition, which I drew on from also in the novel.
Well, I was going to say, from 9/11, you go back to Amy and Jack being in their newly acquired Maryland abode. And that night, he has a heart attack. So in terms of storytelling, you've juxtaposed the heart attack with 9/11. But in truth, it's what, a month apart or something like that, or 2 months apart, maybe even longer than that. I guess it's September to December, so several months. So he has this heart attack. So Amy doesn't get to go to New York the next day the way she had promised her boss that she would. And in fact, for a couple of days, she doesn't go to New York.
Right.
Right.
Lots of tension because she really wants to be at work and really does not want to be home or at her new abode in Silver Spring.
One of the things that you present in this depiction of Amy's life is choices and challenges. I mean, as we've talked about it, she still has room to grow in her career. She still has, she hasn't capped out by any stretch. And she has a boss who admires what she does, who appreciates what she does. They ping things off of each other pretty well. She loves her husband, and yet there's a kind of tension in their relationship. They've been married at this point 20 years, and they have one child who they both adore and dote on, but she makes choices. I think one of the ways, aside from the dramatic evocations and depictions, one of the ways that you move the novel along is to continue to present choices for Amy. Is that deliberate craftspersonship?
Yes. I'm someone who sees life in terms of choices. But I also think that raises the stakes. It brings conflict in. I think a lot of, I know a lot of young writers and a lot of, unfortunately, or women writers want to be nice to their characters. I mean, I knew Amy was tough and that she would be facing some major decisions in life. And I think those are drawn on my own life. But I also think from a craft point of view, it makes you sort of want to know what's next for her. I did want a propulsion to the novel. I mean, she has had quite a life, but I didn't want it to be melodramatic. So I'm hoping sort of got that sort of fine line.
I didn't find it melodramatic at all. I think it's because you don't do a lot of exposition. You don't do a lot of internalization. You let Amy act. You let Amy make choices or see choices and then act. And even if the act is to what I would call choice avoidance or delay, as we know, sometimes that's its own choice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very insightful, Bill.
One of the choices she has to make is whether to stick with Jack. She has another possibility. There is a character, a male character, who, other than her boss, I mean, her boss is one kind of interest for her, but there's also another love interest.
Yes, which is, I know you're being very kind, dancing around, not giving a major plot point away, but yes, I mean, here's a woman who is a passionate woman. She's passionate about life. She's has a secret, and it's part of being in that type of business where it was a really, really up close personal business. I mean, you worked long hours, you went out drinking, you went to conventions, you were with the people at work as much or more as you were with your home family. That's the sort of life that I led. And I think that I wanted to give that to Amy. And what I'm hearing from a few people who have already read the novel is, you know, that sort of work life doesn't exist in the same way anymore. And people are saying it really feels like I'm from another time. We're only talking 25 years ago.
But it does seem to have changed. That was one of the points that I was kind of building toward is the choices that you present for Amy as a career woman and how they may be, antiquated in today's working world or how they are the same. Amy has this choice in terms of her love interest, her husband versus this reporter. But to step back for a second and look at the men, her husband, Jack, knows where Friday night happy hour is, and he goes to the bar and he sees her dancing with in close proximity to this guy who professes love for her, and he turns around and goes home. And he doesn't seem to hold it against her. At the same time, that other love interest is engaged and means to be faithful to that promise that the engagement represents, but also says to Amy, I love you. And he says it to the woman who becomes his wife, and she knows. So I'm interested in how you see the male characters as well.
Well, I love the male characters in the book. I mean, it's really almost a triangle with Jack, Owen, her boss, and her reporter. And I think this is somebody with a big heart, and that's part of her challenge in life. She's also someone who's had a lot of loss in her life. You know, this is someone who grew up without a mother, who grew up, you know, only with her father. And I think she's looking, you know, for connection in the world. And she finds it, you know, more with men than with women. You know, there are many, many novels out there about women's friendship, but she even says at one point in the book, I have no friends. I have no one to call. If it wasn't for Jack, I would probably be alone in the world, Amy says.
Right. And you do show that. I mean, Amy is a boss of other women and she associates with them in professional ways. But even Gracie, her regular assistant, there's a real separateness between them. Gracie is in a sense subservient to her and respectful of her and would do anything for her as long as it's, you know, not stay past, so much past the quitting time. What's interesting to me about this is that the time period in which this happens, 25 years ago or so, the men are thought to be in dominant positions. And yet, in most of these relationships, Amy is clearly the dominant one. She's the stronger one.
Yes. I'm not sure how to respond to that, Bill. I mean, you know, my experience is that in corporate America, you know, the men may be the senior roles, but it's the women who run things, who get things done often.
That fits kind of seamlessly with the whole idea of the other beautiful people and the behind the scenes people who make things happen.
Right.
Yeah. That was your experience, I take it.
Yes. I mean, I had a wonderful boss, but he had one job and I have four jobs, you know, and one of my big jobs was managing him to make sure that things happened. And he was a good guy. You know, I have no regrets, no complaint, but it was a big job. And I think that it's part of who I am. I'm the oldest or eldest of four. By age 9, I was running my own household with my dad. So cooking and cleaning and making sure we all got off to school and all those things. So I've always been a very take charge person, which is probably reflected in my writing a character like Amy Green.
Well, and like Amy, you grew up without your mother after a point. Your mother and Amy's mother suffered a similar kind of fate, if you will.
Yes. The way I modified it for the novel, in my real life, my mom had a stroke, a major stroke when I was 4.5 years old. In the novel, that happened to Amy when she was young. Amy's mother dies when she's 16. And that was a big debate in my head, whether I should have the mother die. In real life, my mother lived on paralyzed and brain damaged till I was almost 50 years old. So I didn't lose my mother. I knew exactly where she was, and I was her legal guardian, and I cared for her as much as I could. But I thought it would be more dramatic, again, raising the stakes for Amy if she didn't have a mother. If really at age 16, she had lost her mother and had a father who stayed, just like my father stayed, but with a lot of quirkiness.
And he becomes another male character in the book and use the word quirky. Talk about him for a few moments, how you drew him. I mean, in my thinking, I'm leading toward, under stress, Amy begins to see him, the ghost of him, and he gives her advice in his ghostly form.
Right. So when the novel opens, he's dead just about a year and goes back up in black and white and sort of looking like Danny Kaye in her mind. Long, lean, easygoing guy to some extent, but somebody who really wants to give her advice, and she doesn't really want to take it. So a lot of their scenes is filled with this back and forth about, oh, I thought you always wanted to be a writer. Oh, I never wanted to be a writer. Oh, but so what do you do? Which is actually a question my real father could never figure out what I did in life. When I worked at Bravo and AMC and IFC, it was so beyond his realm of thinking that his daughter would have ended up in a position like I did, that he could not fathom what I did. Not that he wasn't happy, but, you know, in his mind, women became teachers or they became, you know, mothers. So, and I was doing neither of those.
Right. That circles us back, doesn't it, to the central theme of the book and of your analysis of that time period, which is the other beautiful people are invisible for the most part.
Yes. When you turn on your TV set and or you go to the movies, you think of the actors, maybe the directors. You don't think of the person who created the print or video campaign that's, you know, got you into the movie theater. You don't think of the people who are the lighting sound people. You don't think of the people who are the PR people bringing people up the red carpet. You think they magically appear on the red carpet. All of this is hours and hours and hours of planning. And it's a business too, which is, you know, Amy is somebody who wants to put on a show. She wants to bring people together. She's faced at one point, you know, with the business of the business. And that also totally disrupts, you know, everything in her life.
It does, because the thing her boss tells her when she finally gets to work after Jack has his heart attack and she has to be with him for a couple of days. And then she's like, fine, you're good, I'm leaving. The movie channel they work for is owned 49% by one company and 51% by the other. And the 49% company is selling to the 51% owner, so that it becomes 100%. That's bigger upheaval in some ways than 9/11 was.
Well, it hits her directly.
And the other people that she works with and the people who are looking to her for guidance and to work this through. I mean, she becomes at that point really central in a lot of people's lives.
Yes. And again, another dramatic turn in the book, another facing choices and consequences, but done in a way that I think what you're going for, Bill, too, that it's all like on a very personal level. Like this doesn't open up to big exposition about, you know, the world changing and the media business, you know, and the conglomeration of the media business, all could have, which have been commented on. It doesn't matter. What matters is, am I going to have a job tomorrow?
Exactly.
And am I going to have a job doing what I love, which is working at movie channel?
Right. And the thing that sets this up and carries it through so well is that shifting that I referred to earlier between like 9/11, where you have the panic, the chaos on the grand scale, but you also have the moments and the chaos on the minor scale. And then you get into the business world. And again, you're shifting between the minor and the maximum, but it's all major for the people who are going through it. Whether you're looking at the big chaos or the smaller chaos, it's their lives that they're talking about. In that sense, the novel is very well constructed and it coheres stylistically in a lot of solid ways.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think it always does come down to the most personal stories. It doesn't matter if the world's ending. I mean, that's terrible. You know, what are you going to do today if the world's ending? And that's how I always think, you know, how we tell stories. And there's actually a psychological basis for that. You know, bringing in things like 6 million people may have died in the Holocaust, but who do we remember is Anne Frank, right? We can only really grasp the horror through that one story. I'm not comparing my story to Anne Frank, but just the psychological basis, I think, for how we should be telling stories, right, is not this grand scheme. It's how that one person must face his often their own self.
Right. Well, and I think that's part of the power of this novel, right? Is that Amy, she is a strong woman. We admire her for that, but she's also a vulnerable person. Whether we're talking 9/11 or we're talking the business world, whether we're talking the love triangle and the choices she has to make about that or other aspects of her life, she's strong, but she's also vulnerable.
Aren't we all in some way?
I think so. And I think that's the attachment point that we have?
Well, I find it interesting that, I mean, you are probably a person I would say is not my ideal reader. I thought the ideal reader is me. And I think that you reading and being so insightful really gives me, you know, hope that this novel speaks to a larger audience.
Well, it spoke to you. You wrote it, so.
I know. But I wrote it thinking that there were readers like me, like, you know, career women or ex-career women of a certain age. I mean, the only thing constant is change, right? That's an old saying. And for Amy, that's particularly true. And in constructing the novel, I really grappled with the time period. How long a time should we stay with Amy? You know, and I realized that at one point I had to speed up the whole novel at the end as her story was over in a way when the cinema channel became something else, because her whole reason for loving work was the people and then the movies.
You talk about change. I was looking for the exact quote, but basically, cutely, you have their son, Adam, say that to Amy. Life has changed, Mom, right? I mean, here's this 22-year-old saying it to his mom.
Well, you and I both have sons, and sometimes they're really smart. They're really observant of you. They're watching us all the time, our kids. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun writing Adam. One change from my real life to the book in real life, I got married very young. I got married at 22 to someone, yes, who I met at Syracuse University, just like Amy met Jack. We delayed for our own decision. We delayed having kids for almost 16 years. So I didn't have kids till I was very much in my late 30s.
But you had a lot of fun in the meantime.
I did. I had a great career. I traveled all over the world. I loved my job. My husband went back to law school in his 30s and developed a whole second career. We lived in Manhattan in a tiny apartment. I mean, we had that whole life. And so we delayed having kids. It actually ended up propelling me out of business world, going back to my first love, which was always wanting to be a writer. But in the book, again, to have stakes raised for Amy, well, to have a kid and a career and it being 2001 was a huge thing.
And not to give too much away, but Amy finds her son following a little too closely in her footsteps at one point, which is why he says that line to her about change.
Like I said, I had a lot of fun writing the son and that sort of the brief moments with him. I think that's where Amy's probably the most vulnerable is with her own son, where with the other men in her life, she almost has a, you know, a barrier. Like she's always projecting what they want her to be. You want me to be a good wife? I'll be a good wife. You want me to be the super employee? I'm the super employee, you know? But with her son, she could be vulnerable.
And I think you also had fun in the son's relationship with the woman who becomes his wife.
Yes.
In a sense, it kind of replicates Amy because Robin is, let's just take this. She can drive a Mustang like crazy and right. And he can barely drive anything.
Right. Well, he's a city kid and certainly probably the most fun. I had to take out, actually edit this back. I had so many rooms. So at one point, Jack's parents show up at the door, you know, all ready to help and cause more chaos. But the father just kept saying, vroom. We got in the Mustang and it was vroom, vroom, vroom. And I had so much fun writing that word even. I had to take out probably half of them. I know it's just one word, Bill, but, you know, and it just said everything about this sort of, you know, 7-year-old guy that he got to ride in a Mustang.
This book is published by Regal House Publishing, which you thank them for this. This is a women-run press?
Yes. So it's a independent press. It's down in Raleigh-Durham. It's run by a fabulous woman, started by a woman named Janie Royal. So she runs it, has a whole female staff, publishes about 60 books a year, was 2 years ago called the top independent publisher by Forward Magazine. And it is almost a fluke this novel got published. I wrote it thinking I wasn't writing a novel. I'm just going to be writing a whole bunch of flash pieces. Turned out then one day I realized I had 50 or 60,000 words written. I made an attempt at getting an agent. I had an agent for my first two books, which were young adult novels, Lying Before My Eyes. And those went out to St. Martin's and did very well. But my agent at the time had a baby and was wanting to take a step back and said, I'm not going to represent fiction anymore. I'm sorry, Caroline. And I said, that's fine. I'm really not writing any adult novels anymore. I think I'm going to be writing short stories and maybe other things. And then there was a gap as I was raising my kids, as often happens. So when I went back to get a literary agent, I could not find one. And I decided to submit to Regal House's contest. They have a novel contest. And wonderful writer named Martha Ann Toll had won the year I was thinking of this for Duet for One. And I said, well, if Martha won, maybe I could win. I didn't win. I was so disappointed. I literally went off the internet for a few weeks. And I missed an email from Regal that said, even though you didn't win, we really want to consider your book for publication. So I had to write a whole email back like, I'm so sorry. It took me weeks to respond to you, but I would be very interested in talking with you. And they bought my book directly from me without a literary agent.
Congratulations. That's a very good story.
It's, you know, it's a small miracle it got published, but from, you know, the I started writing it in 2022. It's 2026, so 4 years writing to publication.
Including sitting around trying to get an agent for it after you drafted it and working on it and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, there's always those periods in there in the process.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And you mentioned the YA books, but you also had a story collection that came out prior to this. And that was not a YA story collection, I don't think.
Not at all, Bill. Not at all. When I decided I really wanted to write fiction that was very much for adults, even though I thought my YA books were for adults, but they were sold as YA novels. And I started writing short fiction. And I discovered flash fiction, which I had never written before. And that sort of really opened me up and freed me to write, you know, very short pieces. So I started writing those as well as longer pieces, and they were put together a collection. I realized at one point, oh, maybe all these fit together. They seem pretty linked about traumatic childhood and family drama. And I went back to my agent, even though she had said she wasn't representing fiction. And she said, no, I'm really not representing fiction. And there's no market for short story collections. So I was like, oh, okay. So I had just moved to DC a few years before. I'm a born and bred New Yorker, born in the Bronx, raised in New Rochelle, New York. But I moved in 2013 with my husband to the DC area. He was a federal employee, just retired. And I started looking at the opportunities in the area and realized there was a press called the Washington Writers Publishing Press that had a fiction prize. And I said, well, I'll send my stories off there. And I did. And I won the prize in 2018. And it's 47 short stories that range from 100 word pieces to full length short stories.
Yes. And the title of it is Carry Her Home.
Right.
And as you said, it was published by the Washington Writers Publishing House. Two of the longer stories in there share some seeds, I think, with the novel that we've been talking about, in the sense of being autobiographical. I think they, loosely speaking, I think it's you interpreting your parents meeting each other in New York. You do one from your mom's perspective and then one from your dad's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
How was that to write? And how much were you fictionalizing and how much were you listening to what they had said to each other and to you?
Wow, Bill. Yes, there's two very long stories. Those are the longest stories probably in the center of the book. I can't even remember their titles, to be honest.
To interrupt, the titles are Louise at the Palladium Ballroom and The Day After the Dance, I think.
But you did read them.
I did.
Well, so I knew very little about how my parents met each other. As I shared earlier, my mother had, you know, a major stroke, aneurysm, which put my father, you know, as the primary caregiver and without a lot of family or additional support. So he raised four kids on his own and was a remarkable, quirky guy. And part of the challenge was that my father didn't really want to talk a lot about my mother. What I knew was just the scant details. And later, when he probably would have talked about her, I was too busy with my own life. So probably not uncommon, you know, when you suddenly realize I have to be asking these stories. It was too late. My father passed about 10 years ago. And then I realized, well, I'm just going to have to recreate their stories from what I know. So what did I know about them? I knew my mother was daughter of Italian immigrants, Sicilian. I knew that she loved to dance. I knew that they had met at a dance. I knew that she had lied to her parents and said they met at one type of dance, but my father had said, no, they definitely met at a Times Square dance hall. I knew that I had been told by my mother's mother that my parents had to get married in the way in 1962, if you got a woman pregnant, you got married. However, I realized toward my end of my father's life, that wasn't exactly true. that they had met at the dance. They were not kids. They were in their 30s, which in 1960 meant my mother was an old maid and my father was unmarriageable, you know. And they did not have to get married. My mother had a miscarriage, but they married anyway. And my father is Jewish. And in 1962, you know, unlike today, that was a very, very big deal. And so I knew in those writing those stories, I put a lot of that tension in it. And, you know, my mother was also, and this is also why my father didn't talk about her. So I had always been told my mother worked for the army. No, what she really did, as far as I could tell, was in the OSS and then in the CIA, most likely as a translator, because she spoke fluent German and Italian. So there was a whole part of the family lore that really everybody felt they could not talk about because of her position there. And in fact, she only left service because she was pregnant with me. But all of the other details that the family in Maspeth, I knew my Italian family very well. I knew that my father was a great dancer. The actual Palladium scene, I did some historical research, and there was this fascinating night that it was raided because of basically New York City politics. But back then, there was segregation in the dance halls, and the Palladium just had everybody there from New York.
We could talk a lot about these stories. I loved your depiction of your grandmother, your mother's mother, and when your father comes to the home for dinner, Sunday dinner, which is, you know, sometimes starts in the afternoon and ends just before sunset, and the way she carries on. And I could see a lot of characters, but a lot of the characterization you give to your mother, the character you depict, you know, as your mother in the story, and how she gets those traits from her mother, and how it carries forward. You use the term autofiction to sometimes talk about your writing. What do you mean by that?
Well, autofiction is a, you know, sort of a broad term, actually, I think with French underpinnings of, you know, highly autobiographical fiction. It's almost a meld of fiction and memoir. And I often challenge myself and ask myself, am I writing memoir? Am I writing fiction? And I always end up on the fiction side because of, first of all, wanting just to make up stuff and make up characters and for the story and the craft to collapse timelines, which I definitely did in The Other Beautiful People. But I don't think that I could ever be the person who is writing about dragons or wizards or, you know, I can't write outside myself. I was thinking the other day of a quote by Eudora Welty. I write about what I don't know about what I know. And the older I get, and this is me, I realize how much I don't know about myself, my background, my history. But, you know, to some extent, all fiction is autobiographical. We're drawing it out of ourselves. But I will push that and really try to nail down things that actually happened, which is what happened more and before my eyes. You know, and before my eyes, you know, I was there in Manhattan planning a press conference. Even if I wasn't actually in the city that day, I was supposed to be in the city. I was in the city 2 days later.
Well, and that would be my point. When you say you can't write about dragons, I mean, that's a form of a dragon in a sense, right? It's a representation of a dragon. And when you talk about, you know, wizards, Amy is a wizard in a sense.
Well, she makes things happen.
Exactly. That's what wizards do. That's what wizards do.
Well, thank you.
Your life has been richer and given you more material to work with than the average writer, or whether you're just better at mining that material and inventing out of it to produce the work that you've produced with such vivacity in the writing itself. What do you think?
Well, thank you for that adjective, vivacity. Well, I'm not a kid, you know? I mean, I'm 63 writing my first novel for adults, so you know, when I first started out thinking I would be a writer in my 20s, you know, I don't think my writing had this sort of depth. I had basically put it aside for 20 years, even though I had many teachers and wonderful, fabulous teachers telling me, no, write that story now. It took me, you know, 20, 30 years to actually write it. That's probably what you're reading in The Other Beautiful People and in Carry Her Home.
And in a sense, in that Carry Her Home, a series of 47 or so stories, was a kind of rehearsal for the novel, The Other Beautiful People, in a sense, that you were working some of the same autobiographical material, more compressed, working through it, looking at it. That's what we all do, right? We set it down on the page or the screen, and then we look at it and then, you know, send it out and see what the world has to say about it. And then ultimately, like you did, you come back to it and you form a novel out of it. And we all hope it does well.
Thank you. And I do think that there are many, many young writers, because I love reading new writers. I love reading young writers who can get their story down early. I think it's just me. I think I do mull things over. Part of my personality that I have to take the world in for a long time. And I really admire people who can get things down on the page a lot faster than I can. So.
Well, at whatever speed one gets it down on the page, I think one of the other things to take away from this is to keep at it.
Yes.
I mean, it's axiomatic, right? But if you quit writing, you're never going to get published. You've got to keep writing. You got to keep sending it out there.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much for this conversation. This has been delightful. The title of the book, again, is The Other Beautiful People. It is releasing on the 2nd of June, and it'll be available wherever books are sold. And my guest is the author, Caroline Bock.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps others find the show. You can also watch full episodes and clips from Upstart Crow on our YouTube channel. Be sure to follow us on social media and visit upstartcrow.org for more information about our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of those links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.